Anyway, what you're about to hear is an interview or a segment of an interview with Dr. Leedy Forrest shortly before his death.
Every year, when we open our radio classes, we always start off by telling the story of how voice broadcasting began. And I know the students would much prefer to hear it from your standpoint, how you recall that episode, the first successful voice transmission.
Well, long before I was able to transmit the voice through the air, I was resolved on the great possibilities of such a development. Broadcasting appealed to me long before there was such a thing available. And my prime idea in developing the radio phone was to devoted to broadcasting music and educational programs over wide areas from a central transmitter. Of course, I had in mind also the point-to-point use of the radio telephone, especially from ship to shore and from ship to ship. But the thing that appealed to me even more strongly than that purpose was the idea of reaching masses of people by means of this new medium. And from the beginning of 1907, when I was first able to transmit my voice and phonograph music broadcast from my laboratory in New York, I worked to develop that phase of the radio telephone. At that time, very few indeed had any conception of the possibilities of broadcasting. Those to whom I spoke, radio or electrical engineers, thought only of the point-to-point service. I remember distinctly that when I went to visit some of my classmates in order to enlist their financial aid in my development work, and explained to them that the device was not useful in the cities where there's a large number of telephone conversations to be carried on, that the interferences would limit us perhaps to a dozen or 20 transmissions in the same zone, they said, well, what possible use is the thing if you can't replace the telephone by it? They could not see the advantage of broadcasting. And it was not long, however, after I began to broadcast, that the radio amateurs who were around the neighborhood began to hear voices and music over their receivers instead of what they always heard before, dots and dashes of the Morse code, became very enthusiastic about it. And it spread among that fraternity very fast indeed.
What is it, Bill? Do you think I'll live to be 100 years old?
Well, I don't know. Let me see. Do you smoke?
No.
Do you drink?
No.
Do you stay out late at night?
No, sir.
Do you run around with the flapper?
I should say not.
Well, what in the world do you want to live to be 100 years old for? Well,
Lindbergh is coming down as a gang fence.
There's the boy.
He's come forward. Honest, Romy. Quiet. Very serious. And awfully nice.
And now the National Broadcasting Company and Associated Radio Station are going to ask you to just listen, because particularly this is the first time band music or music has been transmitted from the Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast, which is another epoch. We will listen to the band.
Hello? Yes, this is Eddie Cantor. The maternity ward. Ida what? Okay, I'll be right over. Why doesn't somebody tell me these things?
Now, Snooks, tell me, what do you have to do for homework today?
A composition.
You have to write a composition on what?
On how I spent the day at home.
Why, it's a blank sheet of paper with nothing on it.
Oh, I didn't do nothing all day.
The manufacturers of radio receivers would be the ones who would profit by the widespread popularity of the broadcasting idea, and we would get our revenues largely from that source. I did not think very much of the advertising idea, and deplored very strongly the commercialization of our programs when that operation began in 1920. But it was soon evident that here was an unexpected and unrivaled opportunity for advertising and obtaining large financial support for the broadcasting stations.
Many times since this period, you indicate, you've been very outspoken on your ideas concerning the uses of your invention, and more particularly, I think, the misuses of radio broadcasting. As you already indicated, advertising. Now, to what extent also do you think radio has been abused in its development?
Well, aside from the advertising, the commercialization of the programs, which is vastly overdone from the very beginning, I deplored the program content. So many of the programs, instead of being devoted to cultural and educational purposes and the better class of music, they rather sought to develop the popular idea of jazz, boogie-woogie music, and the vaudeville type of radio entertainment. Now that was another source of great disappointment to me, that the program content was so debased. So the vast majority of the programs became moronic. I always maintained that the programs could be made just as popular and still have an uplifting tendency or influence. But that idea was not accepted by majority of the program sponsors.
point out, it's been over 30 years now that stations have been putting on programs full-time. What hope do you see that programs may improve? We've already discounted in our earlier discussion the possibility of a complete government subsidy, but should we expect the commercial stations with their big audiences to assume more responsibility for cultural programs, or should we look to full-time educational or full-time cultural stations?
I think that it's a slow process of education. Mass education is always a slow process, but there is progress in that direction, and with the large proportion of high-grade programs, you will find very slowly the demand for such will increase. I think that many of the now well-known symphony orchestras would not be in existence had it not been for the gradual training of the public to appreciate the kind of music that those symphony orchestras play. And the radio is largely responsible for that gradual improvement in the musical tastes of the American public. There's a vast amount of work yet to be done, but that reform is really underway.
Well, then, taking the new trend now, the television that is now developing and expanding at such a tremendous rate, as we actually are beginning at the start of this new medium, can we apply to it the lessons we've learned from the development of radio as far as educational or cultural programming is concerned? Can we avoid any mistakes we made earlier? It appears, at least on the surface now, that television is going to develop exactly as radio did as far as programming is concerned. What can we do now before it gets too far ahead of us?
Too much imitation of radio programs is already evident in the quality of our television programs. Too many television stations are owned by radio owners of radio transmitters, and it's quite natural that they follow the same pattern. They ignore the vastly improved opportunities for cultural programs made available by video. But so long as the main purpose of television seems to be to earn the last possible dollar from the programs, we find what we see today. So many programs are very ordinary quality, developed with a minimum of expense, amateur hours, amateur talent, and amateur music. The television possesses an unmatched power for implanting in the minds of the viewers a desire for interesting and uplifting and educational topics. And it's a sad fact that the desire for obtaining maximum revenue in the shortest possible time impels the program directors to emphasize the amateur talent, which it costs them very little, and the bulk of the programs, where they're not criminal, is in fact devoted to very ordinary topics. They pay large sums, of course, for well-known comedians, but the general tendency of the television program today is to amuse, entertain, and not to instruct or educate. I'm very hopeful that the movement now on foot is quite evident with the FCC commissioners to give television a stated amount of educational time will result in a gradual improvement in the television programs. I'm sure that if, say, 10% of good television hours were restricted to educational and cultural programs, the effect on the American mind would become very evident in a very few years.
But what about color, Dr. Lee Forrest? What about this? I know you are very strong for the RCA system. Do you think there's any possibility that the FCC...
I was amazed that the FCC should come to such an unrealistic decision as they did. It's perfectly apparent to anyone who's acquainted with the technique and the technological factors involved, as well as the sociologic factors involved, that an incompatible television, color television system is absolutely wrong. And so long as there is a compatible television system existent or in prospect of perfection, there is no excuse whatever for authorizing the incompatible mechanical system.
Oh, tell me, doctor, what can be wrong with me?
Say, have you got a headache or water on the knee?
Well, someone said I'm full of prunes, that's why I'm sad and blue.
Say, here's the only remedy.
Please tell me what to do.
Why, orange here, eat some more orange here. From
I don't know. I'll get myself a sun-kissed maiden.
And I'll bet you like her orange.
Oh, the fruit of the old apple tree.
Here's a lot of apple plums today.
Say, why oranges? Eat more oranges. From California.
Say, Bill, you know.
As you know, the 19th century, among other things, is notable for the so-called Industrial Revolution. The invention of steam, of the power loom, of electricity, of mass production machinery, clearly indicated that society was on the threshold of overcoming the enemies of want and insecurity.
So I went in the closet to get the card table, and when I was in there, I happened to see three or four of them quarantine cards with scarlet fever written on them in your closet.
Well, now, Amos, just a minute.
Lock the door. We got him.
Yeah, when you get out of here, you're going to have worse than scarlet fever.
Lock the door. Lock the door, King.
Hello, Rudy.
Oh, Joe, how are you?
You want to buy a duck?
No, Joe, I don't want to buy a duck.
Why?
Because.
Well, maybe your brother would like to have one, huh?
I haven't a brother.
Well, if you had one, you think he'd consider it?
No.
Under no circumstances?
Under no circumstances.
You nasty boy! I was suffering from swollen thighs. Sitting down too much, I suppose. They made a mistake and brought me camphor balls instead.
Did you swallow them?
Yeah, and every time I sneeze, dozens of moths fly out.
What?
Yeah, a covey of moths closely followed by a bevy of silverfish.
A bevy?
Flying in V formation. Light fly on the wing.
Hey, Bill,
here's a
Bill,
sign.
Bill, now look, Bill.
When the little
Bill,
children...
Bill, now look, hold everything.
Please. Oh, sir, you won't believe this, but Bing, down there in the water was the sweetest little trout you ever saw.
What's that got to do with you hearing my singing?
Well, sir, Bing, this little fish was sticking his little head right up out of the water. You know how fish do.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of blowing bubbles and going boo, 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 boo at me. I'm going to tell you, Bing, I pretty near cried. Yeah, sir. He wagged his little tail at me, and he said, boo, 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 until I just had to take it with me.
Mm.
And all the way back to camp, and all night long, he just kept wagging his tail and saying, boo, 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 at me, until there was only one thing left for me to do.
You brought him here?
No, I ate him for breakfast.
Well, that certainly should have put a stop to his boo, 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 boo.
No, sir, Bing, it didn't.
He continued the boo, boo, boo?
Yes, sir, once before I ate him, and twice after.